Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and often interrupt our daily lives. Identified as a landmark piece of legislation, the Federal Housing Act became law in April 1968. President Lyndon Johnson signed the bill creating the FHA 1 week after Martin Luther King's assassination in a tribute to King's fight for housing equality. This year, we commemorate the 56th passage of the Fair Housing Act. April is the National Fair Housing Month, celebrating the passage of the Fair Housing Act, a national law that prohibits discrimination in the sale of rental and financing of housing based on race, color, national origin, religion, and gender, including folks with disabilities and families with children. In 2017, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, author Richard Rothstein asked us to hear the uncomfortable facts about our nation's past, facts we cannot deny no matter one's political view. He details how local, state, and federal policies and laws mandated segregation. Aware that 21st century segregation continues to promote inequality, Richard Rothstein and his daughter, Leah Rothstein, housing expert, teamed together to write Just Action to address historical inequities and challenge residential segregation. It's a blueprint for concerned citizens and community leaders, a guide to ending residential segregation in America. Joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome Leah Rothstein, author and housing expert. Leah, welcome to 411 Team.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming. First of all, I just have to say I applaud you and your father for authoring two powerful, candid, provocative books on segregation and housing in the United States. What was the impetus for writing those books? These policies have been in practice for decades. Why do you care? What does it matter to you? The books were direct. They were hard-hitting, although I'm sure that they had some problems with the powers that be. They've received many accolades, and I just wanted you to know that I approved and thank you for taking the time for sharing that history and information.
Thank you so much. And there's a few ways I can answer that question. I can start with how my dad came to write The Color of Law.
Okay.
He spent a long time working on education issues and studying the education gap, what it's called, the achievement gap between African-American and white students. And what he came to in his research around that, working on that for years, is that it comes down to the neighborhoods that we live in. Our neighborhoods are very racially segregated, and not just segregated by, you know, some people live here and some people live here and everything else is equal, but the neighborhoods where African-American children are limited to living in, those are neighborhoods that have higher pollution in the air, more pollution because the homes are closer to factories or freeways. Mm-hmm. The children have higher rates of asthma. The buildings are older. They have more exposure to lead paint. You know, there's more crime, there's more contact with police, higher levels of stress. So those children come to school with all of these challenges. You know, not every mm-hmm. child has every one of those challenges, but the school as a whole is dealing with a student population that is facing one or more of those challenges in their home lives. They come to school after not sleeping well because they're wheezing from their from an asthma attack, for example. And so there's no way we can expect equal achievement in schools, no matter how high quality the schools in those neighborhoods are. And so that's what came, that's what drew him to start to look at why are our neighborhoods so racially segregated. And what he found is that we have this myth, this idea we've accepted as a country that we're racially segregated by accident or by choice. It's called de facto segregation. And what he showed in The Color of Law is detail after detail of examples of government policies that required the segregation of African Americans and whites to live in separate communities. So he really debunked that myth, and he called that the de facto segregation idea nonsense, because he showed all of the government policies that explicitly created segregated communities and then made sure that communities where whites lived were areas of high resources and investments and higher opportunity than areas where African Americans lived. So that was in 2017. He wrote that book. It had a big impact. I read the book, obviously, and I heard him talk about it. And I was one of many people who came up to him after hearing him speak about The Color of Law and said, you know, it's so important that we're really reckoning and remembering this history of how we came to be segregated. But what do we do about it? It's not clear how we get out of it. And I've worked on these issues for a long time. I see also that the neighborhoods we live in have a big impact on our life outcomes and in how we relate to each other. And I think we're both motivated by, you know, wanting to create a more equitable, fair society where people get along and respect each other. And we can't do that if we live so separate from each other. You know, the political polarization in this country today is due in part because we don't live around people who look differently from us. We don't understand each other. So when I asked him, what do we do about it? His answer was, why don't you help me answer that question? So we, like typical dad.
Yeah, right.
So eventually I said, okay. And we wrote this book to show that there's actually a lot that we can do in our own communities to challenge segregation and to remedy its ongoing impacts. And in fact, if we live up to our obligation as Americans, as residents of this country, then we have an obligation to a responsibility to do something about this, because our government broke the law in the past in creating segregation and treating Blacks and whites differently. And so we now have an obligation to remedy that and to fix the consequences of those policies that the government enacted.
Well, I applaud you again. I mean, I think it was very well done, and more power to you. Because as you mentioned, today, here we are in April 2024, and housing is segregated, and schools remain largely segregated. And Black and white people don't live in the same neighborhood. But in the mid-20th century, I guess, the federal law pursued two important, I guess, policies that segregated the metropolitan areas. And I wanted to kind of address that. I think the first one was this kind of civilian public housing. It seemed like they demolished integrated neighborhoods to create segregated housing. And then the second part of the federal government, they subsidized the development of suburbs on a condition that they be only sold to whites. The homes had deeds that prohibited resale to African Americans. And now you correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the worst offenders is the Federal Housing Administration.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, all right, because I read the
You're
books.
Not wrong.
I read the both of them, and I was like, wait a minute. They're causing all of this. Why did the government agency have so much influence over where people live? Why did the FHA, what did they do to prevent Black people from buying and owning homes? Because I think my listening audience needs to hear specifics.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll start with your first example about the public housing, which started to be built in the Great Depression as part of the New Deal. And you're right. You're exactly right that the federal government, you know, wanted to meet the housing need of people during the Depression, which is an odd, you know, great goal, but went into urban areas that were fairly integrated because our country was fairly integrated at the time. In urban areas, everybody had to live near the factories where they worked. And so, you know, those factories employed different races. So people sort of lived around each other. And the federal government came in to build public housing, which wasn't just for, you know, the poorest people, which is how we think of public housing today. It was for working families who couldn't afford housing and there wasn't enough housing for them to live in. So the federal government built public housing, but built separate developments for whites and separate developments for African Americans. So went into fairly integrated urban areas and segregated those neighborhoods by building segregated public housing. One example is in Cleveland. My dad wrote in The Color of Law about Langston Hughes, African American poet and playwright. He wrote in his autobiography. He grew up in downtown Cleveland and it was fairly integrated. He went to an integrated public school. He had white friends and a girlfriend in high school who was white. And then when, you know, Cleveland today is not an integrated downtown area, it is segregated because soon after Langston Hughes grew up, the federal government came in and built public housing in downtown Cleveland where it segregated whites and blacks in separate buildings. And it did that all over the country in all metropolitan areas. So that's one government policy that created segregation where it didn't already exist. And then that segregation, those patterns, they last, you know, that they don't just go away when after the housing is built. Those patterns last for a long time. The other policy or practice that you mentioned had to do with creating, again, meeting housing demand after World War II. When millions of war veterans came home from the war and needed housing, there wasn't much housing. They came home from the war and had babies. There was a baby boom. So growing families, no housing to meet that demand. Again, the federal government stepped in to build housing through the Federal Housing Administration, subsidized the building of suburban developments all over the country. So at the time, we weren't a suburban economy. Most people lived in urban centers, not in suburbs like we do today. But the federal government wanted to meet this demand for housing and did so by moving white families out of urban areas into suburban developments. And one example of that that a lot of people know about is Levittown, which is outside of New York City on Long Island. A builder there named William Levitt decided he wanted to build a suburban development, 17,000 homes.
Leah, hold your thoughts. Hold your thoughts for a moment. This is one of those times where I said I would have to interrupt you rudely.
And no problem.
We need to take a quick break, and I'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and again, I welcome Leah Rothstein. Leah, I had to interrupt you rudely. Would you continue your thoughts?
Of course. So I was describing how the federal government created suburbs all around the country in the mid-20th century, in the 1940s, after World War II, 1940s and 50s. And one example is Levittown outside of New York City. A builder there, William Levitt, wanted to build 17,000 homes. He couldn't finance building 17,000 homes himself. He couldn't get a bank loan because people didn't live in suburbs at the time. It was a rural area. It seemed crazy. The only way he could build his 17,000 homes was with backing from the federal government through the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA. So the FHA gave him the subsidy, helped him build Levittown on the condition that he promised not to sell the homes in his development to African Americans. And not only promised not to sell them, but he had to write in the deeds of the homes that the home could only ever be owned or occupied by whites. So they couldn't even be resold to blacks later. Now, this is no longer legal, but the repercussions of that last for generations. So when Levittown was created, and this is just one example, suburbs like the like Levittown, you know, suburbs all around the country were created like Levittown. The white families who moved into those suburbs, they also got subsidized mortgages through the federal government. And so they got homes that were affordable. They cost about $100,000 in today's money. That's a very affordable home. And today those homes cost, you know,
Oh, yeah.
$400,000, $500,000, $600,000, some places $1 million or more. Those white families who got into home ownership when it was affordable over the generations built up wealth through the home values increasing. They could then hand down that wealth to their children and grandchildren to buy their own homes, while African Americans were explicitly prohibited by government policy written in government manuals that explicitly prohibited from participating in home ownership when it was affordable. So that's why, you know, we have the Fair Housing Act that was passed 56 years ago. But today, Levittown still is mostly white. It's 2% African American in a surrounding area that's 13% white. So even though we can't discriminate anymore in the sale of or rental of housing, it's somewhat of an empty promise when we have this wealth gap that exists between African Americans and whites. It's a result of government policy.
And the other thing that I noted is that the zoning laws were created so that whites wouldn't even be interested in moving into black neighborhoods. I mean, like the black neighborhoods became the undesirable places. I mean, they had the, as you mentioned earlier, they had the industrial plants and they had the waste plants. And, you know, it made it look like, wow, blacks live in these slums in these areas. And so consequently, why would we want to even consider moving into those areas? At least that's the way I read it. Okay.
No, that's exactly right. We did it through zoning, through housing costs. So African American families in those neighborhoods that they were forced to live in had to double, triple up in homes because there weren't enough homes in those neighborhoods for them to live in. So then the country develops this idea that African American neighborhoods are slum,
right?
Slum conditions, and that they're overcrowded, and that's how people like to live. And it's not true. It was forced on them by government policy.
It was social engineering.
Yeah.
That's what I thought about. So that this is social engineering. I mean, it's social engineering, you know, to keep black folks out. So that's what it's about. But what about the Fair Housing Act? I mean, what did it do? I mean, I guess it really couldn't do anything at that point, huh?
Well, the Fair Housing Act does, it's future looking, it's forward looking.
I said, that's what I meant. It couldn't do anything about what had happened in the past.
Yeah, it doesn't try to do anything about what happened in the past. Okay. So we can no longer discriminate in the sale and rental of housing. So when that happens, we can prosecute, file lawsuits. But it doesn't do anything to address the disparities that exist today because of past government policies. And so we need additional measures to remedy the impacts of segregation and the impacts of past discriminatory government policies if we're truly to have a fair housing, you know, landscape in this country.
So basically, and you mentioned this at the very beginning, the color of law demolished the myth that blacks and whites live separately by choice. It really wasn't by choice.
Okay. No, there was very little choice about it.
The federal, state, and local governments promoted and reinforced neighborhood segregation.
That's right.
Okay, so I got that right. All right. it's a lot of information to take between the color of law and just action. I don't know about others, but my head was just spinning, okay, as I was reading this. It's a lot to take in. I would go back and read it over and say, now, am I reading this right? Okay, because the color of law recounts how the government at all levels created segregation.
Right.
And then just,
right. And it's a lot to sort of rethink in our brains how we think about our neighborhoods. That they didn't just happen that way by accident.
Right. So, and then you come along, which is great. You and your dad come along together and do just action. How to challenge, you know, segregation that was enacted under the color of law. And what you do is describe, you know, what we can do, how we can undo it. But what role, I wanted to ask you, what role does gentrification play?
Yeah, gentrification plays a role in What often happens in lower-income, segregated African-American communities when they start to see an increase of investment and resources, which is what we want for those communities, you know, we want to make those areas areas of higher opportunity, access to jobs, open space, cleaner air. But unfortunately, when that happens, often people with higher incomes then become interested in that area and they move in, they can pay higher prices for the homes there, higher rents. And so the housing prices go up and the longtime residents are displaced. So in Just Action, we describe, you know, dozens of strategies that local communities can take on to challenge and remedy segregation. And one of the categories of strategies we talk about are those that increase investments in lower income segregated African-American neighborhoods. And we say that those strategies have to be coupled with what are called anti-displacement strategies. So policies and programs to prevent some of the displacement that can occur when gentrification happens. Because we don't want the fact that gentrification might occur to stop us from improving those neighborhoods and making them areas of higher access to opportunity and resources. We want to do both at the same time.
Yeah, but what happens is, at least what I see going on, is that these lower income families, once they go in with gentrification, have no place to go.
Right.
You know, so they're left kind of, I don't know what they do.
Yeah, well, the pattern, I believe how it's been is, you know, the federal government helped move white families out to suburbs and left urban areas for African-Americans, other people of color. And then as those urban areas start to gentrify, now those residents, they can't live in the suburbs. They're too expensive. They now can't live in their gentrifying community. So they get pushed out to farther out suburbs. And that's, that's difficult for everybody. Yeah. It hurts our whole local economy when people have to commute for hours to their jobs.
And the resources, they don't have grocery stores, okay?
Right.
You know, they have dollar stores, so you know their intake is impacted.
Exactly. So, they lose their community ties, their churches, community groups.
Well, you know, I would think that you probably receive some criticism because folks would say, well, people often want to live among others who share a common history. You know, the Jewish communities, we have Italian communities, we have Hispanic communities. So why are we even thinking about forcing integration? Why is integration important? Does it matter? I mean, folks are happy being amongst their own.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Okay. And I respect that and agree. And we don't argue for forcing integration on African-American families or households. The other sort of groups that you mentioned, Jewish communities, Italian communities, Asian, you know, enclaves, those are all freely chosen areas where you live around people who look like you. And they're often, you know, earlier immigrants who come to this country and live around in like ethnically similar enclaves, freely chosen. Again, African-American families have not been able to freely choose where they live. So in these other ethnic neighborhoods, often a few generations later, after the first, you know, generation immigrates, they then integrate into other areas of the country. Their children, grandchildren move out of these ethnically homogenous enclaves. African-Americans, they have not, the segregation of African-Americans has not changed in generations. It persists, and that is because it is not always freely chosen. There's not access to other neighborhoods if they want to leave those segregated neighborhoods.
It's so we're systemic not saying, racism. Call it what it is. I mean, you all are real candid. I really recognize that. Not to me, it's just a legacy of systemic. I hated to interrupt you, but that's what's going on.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's systemic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's personal. You know, people's personal beliefs, but it's more systemic than personal, I believe, that there are systems and policies in place that keep African Americans from being able to live where they want. Now, not all, I'm sure, will want to live in integrated communities, but some do.
Yes.
And the policies that block them from doing that need to be changed.
Yeah. But it seems like they are being maintained. Now, I'm not talking just about the South, okay? I mean, yes, I'm here in the South. I'm in Florida, Tallahassee, Florida. So people often think, oh, well, you're just talking about the South. Those are the situations that occur in the South. But it's all over the United States. You just mentioned New York.
It is all over. I actually happen to be in Vermont right now at a fair housing event. I spoke at last night, and they're dealing with similar issues in Vermont. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, all over the country, the same patterns, the same policies have created segregation. And all over the country, there are groups working on challenging those mm-hmm. policies and changing those patterns and trying to do something different.
But we continue to sell, rent by those policies. At least that's what I see, that we continue, even though, you know, we have FHA, those policies were established before FHA was created, and we continue to live with those policies.
That's right.
Okay.
Any law that outlaws discrimination, passing that law is only the first step. Then we have to do a lot of work to make sure that law is being enforced. And I could give an example.
Please.
So there's a lot of policies, programs that are racially neutral on their face, but have a racially discriminatory impact. So this is what I mean by doing that hard work of finding where racial discrimination is occurring so we can change the practices around that. And this is, you know, another example of a systemic discriminatory policy. This has to do with the credit scoring system. So we think of credit scores as objective. There's no racial discrimination built into the credit scores, we tell ourselves. Mm. You take your financial history, your history of paying back your debts, and put that into this system that spits out a score. And if you have a high enough score, you can get a mortgage. And if it's really high, you can get a good interest rate on that mortgage. It seems objective, seems, you know, neutral. But when you look at how it works, it only takes into account a certain type of financial history. And it's a type of financial history that mm-hmm. whites are far more likely to have than African Americans. Through no fault of their own, African Americans tend to live in neighborhoods that have fewer bank branches than whites. Even, you know, similar neighborhoods economically, white and black neighborhoods, mm-hmm. the white neighborhood will have more bank branches than the African American neighborhood. So if you grow up, if you live in a neighborhood that doesn't have a bank branch, you might be more likely to use non-traditional financial institutions like payday lenders when you need a loan. If you can't go to the bank and get a loan and access credit that way, you might go to a payday lender. They charge huge interest rates, but even if you pay that back on time in full, that doesn't factor into your credit score. That's not a type of financial history that's counted in a credit score. So another example is if you've owned a home in the past and you've paid your mortgage on time, that will give you a higher credit score. But if you haven't owned a home in the past and you've been a renter your whole life, and African Americans applying for a mortgage are more likely to have been renters before than owned a home in the past. If you've been a renter your whole life and never missed a rent payment, never missed a utility bill payment, you know, perfect financial history, that also doesn't get factored into a credit score. So through no fault of their own, African Americans are less likely to have a credit score at all because they don't have the type of financial history that's even used in the credit scoring system. Mm-hmm. And then those that do have credit scores, they're on average lower than whites. And this doesn't mean that they're, you know, worse candidates for a mortgage. It's just because of how the system is created that the type of financial history that African Americans are more likely to have doesn't feed into a credit scoring system. So a racially neutral program policy that has a racially discriminatory impact. And so if we really want to make the Fair Housing Act, you know, work, we have to challenge the credit scoring system. And there are ways that's being done on the national level. That takes a very long time. So as we wait for that, because what we argue in Just Action is that we should be focusing on local issues, what we can change in our own local communities. So we can go to our local bank branches and credit unions and advocate that they start factoring in rental payment history into their own credit scoring systems. And many have done this, and they will do it if neighborhood groups are organizing and pressuring them to do so. And when they do, it opens up credit access, mortgage access, and home ownership access to African Americans.
Now, there's some communities that consciously defied those policies and those laws. I think of, Mount Airy in Philadelphia. Would you talk about how they did this and where they stand now? Those communities. Those communities that, did not want to be caught up being segregated communities and actively, form community groups so that they wouldn't be caught in that.
Exactly. Yeah. So we described three communities. They were sort of inner ring suburbs near big cities. One was Mount Airy outside of Philadelphia. One was Cleveland Heights outside of Cleveland. And the other was Oak Park outside of Chicago. All three of these communities in the about 1950s, 60s, communities like theirs were, they were all white. And as African Americans started moving into those neighborhoods, they went through what's called blockbusting and white flight. And that is when realtors and local governments would incite fear in the white homeowners in those neighborhoods when Blacks started moving in and tell them that their neighborhood was deteriorating, that it was going to be overrun by African Americans, and so pressured them to sell their homes at low costs and leave their neighborhood. And then those same realtors would jack up the prices and sell the homes to
African Americans. Hold your thoughts. This is that last time I'll say that. Okay. Hold your thoughts for a moment. We need to take a quick break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in, program is 411 Teen, and April is National Fair Housing Month, celebrating the passage of Fair Housing Act in 1968. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with author and consultant to affordable housing developers and local governments, Leah Rothstein. Okay, Leah, I had to interrupt you. Do you continue? We were talking about housing communities.
Yes.
Okay.
I was describing how some mostly white, like inner ring suburbs in the 1950s and 60s started to flip from all white to all African American. And they did that again, not by accident, not natural occurrence, but helped along, pushed along by the real estate industry, by local governments that would incite fear in the white families in these communities when the first African Americans moved into their communities. And incited sort of white flight for all of the white families to leave. They would tell them that, African Americans were going to overtake their neighborhood. Realtors would hire African Americans to walk around the neighborhood to look like the neighborhood was changing. The white families would then get scared, sell their homes at low prices. Those same realtors would then sell the same homes at higher prices to the incoming African-American families. So this is called blockbusting and white flight. And it's how a lot of inner ring suburban communities flipped from all white to all African-American. So we wrote about three communities, Mount Airy, Oak Park, Illinois, and Cleveland Heights outside of Cleveland. All three of these communities saw this happening around them in their neighboring communities and didn't want to do that. They didn't want their community to go that way. They wanted to stay in their neighborhoods and they wanted to create an integrated community that welcomed African-American families and didn't, instill fear in whites to then leave. And they all did it, slightly differently, but all three of these communities, they formed community groups. They met with white families to dispel some of the fears they had. They brought Blacks and whites together to meet each other and get to know each other. And they brought African Americans into their communities to tour around and meet people to show that the area, the neighborhood was welcoming and safe for them. And they did other things, like they passed local policy to prevent realtors from doing this blockbusting and soliciting to try to get whites to sell. One community even passed a law to not allow realtors to put up for sale signs in their whole neighborhood, in their whole community, because that's one way that realtors incited white flight and fear. So they passed policies, they created community groups, they did a lot of community organizing, and they created stably integrated communities where Blacks and whites lived together and the community, you know, thrived. Home prices actually went up because now there's demand from all races to live there. So they all have maintained some level of integration. Unfortunately, now they're all dealing with different issues around housing prices being so high and school segregation happening. But they have all remained integrated because of this intentional effort to do so. So again, we wanted to show some examples, even though these are from, you know, a few decades ago, that it takes community organizing, it takes people coming together, and it's not impossible to sort of challenge and resist the trend to segregate our communities.
Let me ask you, how will these integration policies fly with this whole woke doctrine, with CRT? I mean, maybe, well, I'm out in left field and it doesn't matter, but it seems like that is going to be working against the whole integration policy.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a fair question.
Okay.
My dad likes to tell this story that when he was growing up in Queens, New York, Brooklyn, New York, and he was learning history, that his history teacher didn't let them call the Civil War the Civil War. They had to call it the War of the States, or the War for State sovereignty, or, you know. And so the fact that, you know, what he uses that story to show that they weren't teaching anything right about racial aspect of our country's history.
I have to add this to it. Excuse me for interrupting, but it's like down here, I think DeSantis says, instead of slavery, it was involuntary relocation.
Right. Learning skills, right? Yes.
I had to just add that, but continue.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think the fact that we are teaching about the true history of, you know, the racial oppression in our country means that there is a larger backlash against it. And that's, you know, to be expected. No advances in civil rights and racial justice in this country have come without a backlash. It doesn't mean that we can't continue, that we can't push forward. And I think we can interpret those backlashes as that we're actually making some progress. The fact that, you know, some states like your state is are trying to take this true history out of the schools means that it's actually being taught, which I think is a good thing. And most of these CRT laws trying to ban critical race theory from schools, they're banning, you know, trying to make students feel guilty about the past and to feel, you know, that they had something to do with it. But you can actually,
do you really
you
think that's it?
True history.
Excuse me. Do you really think they're trying to make them not feel bad? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. And I always ask folks, do students really feel bad when they hear that? I just don't know. So
I don't know either.
Oh, okay.
I think I can say when I read it as a white person, when I read this history, I feel a responsibility to do something about it. And I think that's different than feeling
different.
Guilty.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. My grandparents, my ancestors weren't here enacting these laws, but we're here now and we benefit from them. And so we have an obligation to do something to change them.
Okay. Well, in these last 10 minutes or so, I'd like us to focus a little bit more on Just Action. Because in Just Action, you give us some concrete ideas. You show the community groups how they can really make a difference with different policies and different laws. And I'd like to have us look at some of these policies and strategies that you recommend. Hopefully my listening audience will be inspired to read both of the books. In fact, if you will tell us where we could find The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of Our Government Segregated by America, and Just Action, and that is Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Under the Color of Law. Where can we purchase these books?
You can buy both of them anywhere books are sold, Amazon, bookstores. You can also find more information about both of them, as well as links to purchase them on our website, which is justactionbook.org. Also has all of our public appearances around the country where we're talking about it, and links to a Substack column where we're continuing to write about these issues because they're constantly evolving. So we have a free column there that you can subscribe to.
Okay. All right. Now, as we look at Just Action, kind of share some of the details and specifics that you identified as how community organizations can proceed. I think that would be beneficial for my listening audience.
Great. Yeah. Well, what we argue in Just Action is that to enact these kinds of changes locally, we need to build a reactivated civil rights movement that's ready to take on the issue of residential segregation. And to do that, we need to build committees, groups in our own communities that are biracial, that have leadership that's both Black and white, biracial, multi-ethnic groups that come together, have some social relationships to build off of, to then advocate for changes locally. And we understand that because we live in such segregated communities, it might not be easy to develop these cross-race relationships to create these groups.
You are reading my mind, because my next question was, how are we going to do that if we're in these segregated communities in the first place? But go right ahead.
Exactly. So it's maybe difficult, but it's not impossible. And we tell some stories in Just Action of communities that have brought people together from segregated parts of the same city to build relationships. And I'll give one example, which is a great story from Chicago. Mm-hmm. This was a project started by an artist named Tanika Johnson. She's a photographer and an activist. And she took the unique layout of Chicago, which is laid out in a perfect grid. So there's, you know, a street runs all the way through the city and it has a north side and a south side with the same street numbers. The north side of Chicago is mostly white. The south side is mostly African American. She took the map and folded it in half. And when she did that, homes with the same number on the north and south side of the same street sit perfectly on top of each other. And she called those homes map twins. And she took photos of those homes and did an exhibit to show, you know, these homes aren't that different, these map twin homes, but they exist in very different contexts because of the segregation of the communities that they are in. And then she went a step further and went to each of the map twin homes that she had photographed and introduced herself and told the residents there about her project and asked if they wanted to participate. And many said yes. And to participate, they agreed to meet their map twin, meet the person who lived in their twin house on the other side of town, and tour each other's neighborhoods. And they did this. And many of these map twin pairings, you know, they were people who'd grown up in Chicago, lived there their whole lives, and had never known somebody from the other side of town, let alone been to that neighborhood and toured around and seen what it's like. And they met each other, they got to know each other, they realized they had a lot in common, they weren't that different. They then built what they called block twin groups, where whole blocks would get together and support each other, do neighborhood beautification efforts, and they did some mutual support during the pandemic. So this is an example. So Tanika is a photographer, she's an activist, but she's a photographer. And so what would be great next is if a community organizer came into these block twin groups and helped them figure out what they could do to advocate for changes locally to address the segregation of their communities. But it's a great example of, you know, you don't need a perfect grid of a city and a folded map to do this. There's lots of other communities that come up with other ways to bring people together. But they're doing this. They're bringing people together from segregated African-American and segregated white communities to start to get to know each other and build relationships. And that's the necessary first step to building the groups that we'll need to be able to enact the changes that are possible.
Talk some about Section 8 tenants and the discrimination that they encounter and how we can counter that or ban that discrimination. You know, the same thing with low-income housing. And maybe we could place low-income housing in more high-opportunity areas. Would you have time to talk? Yeah, we got a few minutes. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. I would love to. Yeah, Section 8 is a, you know, rental subsidy program for low-income families. And the program, it is what's called a mobile benefit. So people who receive Section 8 can use their voucher to live presumably anywhere in their metropolitan area. But it, you know, and the program had the promise when it was enacted to help low-income families, if they wanted to live in what are called high-opportunity areas, mm-hmm. areas with well-resourced public schools and parks and clean air. But only 5% of Section 8 families can use their voucher to rent in high-opportunity areas. That is a far cry from meeting its potential to be able to do this, to open up access. So one of the reasons is because of discrimination. It is an allowed form of discrimination on the federal level to discriminate against a tenant mm-hmm. because they use Section 8 to pay their rent. But there's about 20 states and 100 cities and counties around the country that have outlawed that kind of discrimination. Mm-hmm. It's called source of income discrimination laws. There are several counties and cities in Florida. Tallahassee is not one of them. But there are many that have these discrimination, anti-discrimination laws on the books. And so if your listeners live in a place that doesn't have a source of income discrimination ordinance, that's something we can advocate for passing. And that would outlaw the discrimination against tenants because they use Section 8 to pay their rent. And then we have to, you know, even once those laws are passed, ensure that they're enforced and monitored and that tenants and landlords know about the law, know how to know when they're discriminated against, that landlords know that there will be repercussions if they discriminate against Section 8 tenants. And that's one piece of the puzzle in helping open up these more expensive areas to lower income families. The other piece that you mentioned is where we build low-income housing. Mm-hmm. You know, we put a lot of federal money into building low-income subsidized housing, and you know, for the most part, it has been sited and put in low-income neighborhoods, furthering the segregation and concentration of poverty in those neighborhoods. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's aspects written into the programs that provide these subsidies to build the housing that make it difficult to build the housing in higher opportunity, higher cost areas. So those aspects of the program need to be changed. Those are state level programs, so we can advocate for changes to those programs to help make it easier to build low income housing in high opportunity, higher cost areas. And then more importantly, I think, is even if we change those policies, there's going to be people in those higher cost, mostly white areas that resist and oppose building low income housing in their neighborhoods. And, you know, there's a long history in this country of neighbors opposing multifamily housing and low-income mm-hmm. housing in their neighborhoods, particularly, you know, higher-income, whiter neighborhoods. So much so that we've given those opposers a name, NIMBYs, not in my backyard.
Right.
People who support housing until you propose a project in their neighborhood, and then they show up and they're very vocal in opposing that housing. Now, we believe that there's as much support for increasing housing opportunity in these neighborhoods as there is opposition. It's just not as well organized, that the supporters don't feel as motivated, or nobody's asking them to come out to support this housing development that's being proposed, while the NIMBYs, the opposers, have a lot of reasons they feel personally threatened or impacted by the prospect of this new housing development. So they show up and they're very motivated. But we can find the supporters and we can turn them out to city council meetings and to planning commission meetings to support making our neighborhoods more inclusive and accessible to all types of families and households. And again, we write about some examples of communities that have done this and actually defeated NIMBY oppositions, even in places, communities you wouldn't expect them to be able to do that. And it just takes talking to neighbors. A lot of people actually, you know, 1 million people read The Color of Law. Mm. And a lot of people want to do something different. They want their neighborhoods to be more inclusive, to be more diverse, to be more accessible. And this is one way that they can live up to that ideal and help make it happen.
Well, it is time out, and I certainly appreciate you. A special thanks for you sharing your expertise. Much appreciation to my listening audience for your time and your ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.